Breaking news this week, miracle in Miami. Private boats from all over the East Coast make the trip from their home ports to Miami, bringing with them desperately needed supplies and even fighting reinforcements. The effort comes as a nation watches with inspiration as the residents of the city, led by a defiant mayor, refuse to surrender to the pandemic. The resistance in Miami has been hallmarked by fierce fighting as the city's enormous living strongholds struggle to maintain lines of communication and supply with the defensive beachhead established along Biscayne Bay. Our war correspondent is in Miami and will bring us the latest. The United States Coast Guard issues an alert to all mariners to be on the lookout for a merchant ship lost and considered to be reanimated. The cargo ship Autumn Dawn, heavy with agricultural products bound for China, was last heard from southwest of Hawaii. Officials fear her entire crew may no longer be among the living, leaving the fate and position of the ship and its precious cargo a mystery. In California, what started as a good-natured competition between two Army sniper teams in the agricultural district of California's Central Valley has become a heated contest that has captured the country's attention. We'll travel to the forward operating base where this convivial tournament is taking place and get all the details from our reporter in the field. And at our RLA discussion table, we'll be joined by Dr. Hiroshi Watanabe, Meiji University's head of robotics and artificial intelligence, who is now working closely with American Armed Forces from his newly established research center at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We'll be asking him about the latest progress in developing a robotic response to the reanimate threat, as well as his harrowing experience escaping Japan. You're listening to Radio Living America, and I'm your host, Brian Andrews. Our top story takes us to the city of Miami, where a civilian effort to resupply the city is being referred to by some as the American Dunkirk. What began as a social media campaign aimed at raising supplies for a single intrepid sailboat captain determined to help the city has turned into an armada of private boats bringing thousands of tons of supplies. Our Kate Malik is embedded with self-defense forces in the Miami defensive beachhead and brings us the latest.
They began arriving earlier this week, from as near as Jupiter Inlet and as far as Virginia Beach. Private yachts, almost exclusively sailboats, have come to Miami loaded with everything, from food and medicine to weapons and ammunition. Some even bringing volunteers to help fortify Miami's heavily battered garrison of local defense fighters. It all began when Jack Jepson of Charleston, South Carolina, announced he would be sailing his 47-foot sailing yacht to Miami, and via a social media campaign asked people in his community to donate what they could for the fighters here. That message quickly spread, and now the marina facilities here in the Miami defensive beachhead are choked with boats trying to offload their cargo. We caught up with Jim Simpson, captain of the 52-foot private sport fishing yacht Money Talks, earlier today as his cargo was being offloaded. Mr. Simpson, tell us where you're from and what inspired you to make the trip to Miami.
We came down from Hatteras, and I think a lot of the boys here so far are from not too far away. But based on the radio chatter we heard coming down, I think there's boats from New Jersey and New York and Massachusetts on their way. When we heard what was going on down here, I called up my brother and my cousin and his cousin and said, we got to get down there and help them boys out. Our city council started a drive, and within a day or so, we had all the donations we could take. The whole boat was filled with one thing or another.
Jim, I can't find it.
God damn it, Thomas. Can't you see I'm talking over here?
But Jim,
you know you already done fucked up one time today. Damn it, Thomas. Give your brain a chance, son. So then, the fellas at the VFW heard we was heading down, and a few of those boys said they wanted to hitch a ride so they could come and get in the fight.
How were you able to find the fuel for a trip with a boat like yours?
Well, I know I wasn't supposed to do this, but when things first went to shit last year, the first thing I did was take the Money Talks down to the fuel dock and gave the kid working there $500 bills and filled her up. I think we took on the last 1,200 gallons they had. I've been saving this tank of fuel for an emergency since then. We have more than enough to get home, so we'll probably offload around 100 gallons of diesel for the guys here.
When do you think you'll be sailing home?
I would expect pretty quick here. I know they got boats lined up in Biscayne Bay waiting to get in. so they need the dock space. The harbor master said they evacuated some kids out of a stronghold last night and asked if we could take them back up north with us. So we were waiting around to see what that's about.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and good luck on your return voyage.
Don't you worry about us. This old girl knows her own way home, and we'll be back in a few days, I guess.
Jim, I found it!
God damn it, Thomas!
I conducted that interview 6 hours ago, and in that time, dozens of boats have been processed here, with dozens more waiting to enter the marina, and possibly hundreds more on their way. The timing of the relief effort could not have come sooner, as Miami strains to hold back the reanimated and resupply their living strongholds. We caught up with Mayor Santiago Vasquez earlier today, where he told us this.
We're not quite on the offensive yet, but we're getting a lot better at creating diversionary tactics that allow us to get in and out of strongholds for short amounts of time. We were lucky enough to salvage some fuel from local marinas, so we're able to get some trucks up to the strongholds to drop off supplies and then evacuate the most vulnerable people out.
What qualifies as vulnerable in a world like Miami?
Mayor, we've got a high priority message coming through from City Hall. Looks like they want to try to send another relief mission up to the airport.
Excuse me for a moment. Remind me the situation up there.
We haven't gotten a resupply mission through to them in 5 days. The place is filthy with RAs. We tried yesterday, but the mission failed with the loss of 2 vehicles and 10 KIA, including a captain. I think City Hall got some intelligence and wants to take another crack at it.
What are they requesting?
They're standing by, ready to give the warno now.
Tell them to go ahead.
City Hall, this is Arclight. We're ready for you to send over the fire mission. Over.
Copy that, Arclight. Sergeant Barrett is prepared to lead a relief effort consisting of 3 vehicles to Miami International Airport via Northwest 7th Street. Scots have reported reanimates, division strength, in the open, milling about the golf course at the Palm Front Country Club. Fire for effect, 2-7 rounds, Grin Square, November Juliet, 741-525, on my command, over.
Tell them we're going ahead with the mission. All right, camaradas, this one's for the airport. You know what to do.
Copy that, City Hall. Fire for effect. 2-7 rounds. Grid Square, November, Juliet, 741-525, on your command. Tell your forward observers to stay low. This is going to be a big one.
Arclight, this is City Hall. Open fire.
Copy that, City Hall. Okay, let's go. I want to see steam coming out of you guys.
I'm sorry. You were saying?
Of course. I was just asking, what qualifies as vulnerable in a world like Miami?
Kids, the elderly, pregnant women. I mean, exactly what you'd expect. We have good lines of communication with our strongholds, and so far they're doing as well as we could hope.
What kind of casualties are you experiencing, and how are you processing the wounded?
Casualties have been heavy, particularly amongst troops trying to conduct relief efforts deeper into the county. But with the volunteers that have been arriving with the sea lift, we're still almost at division strength. Right now, we have a quarantine zone set up at the Intercontinental Hotel, and we're managing our wounded there.
Mayor Vasquez, what is your response to hearing that this is being referred to as the American Dunkirk?
It's a flattering reference, but I'd say they need to study their history a little better.
And why would you say that?
Dunkirk was an evacuation. Nobody here is leaving.
Do you still hold any hopes that a federal relief effort could materialize if you continue to hold on?
If something like that were to develop, of course we'd welcome it. Of course we would. But if I'm being honest, those thoughts don't even enter my mind. We're operating without federal help, and our planning process assumes that's how it will stay.
Now, Brian, in the time that I've been reporting on this segment, 7 boats have offloaded their cargo and been replaced at the docks by 7 new boats, with many, many more waiting their turn out in Biscayne Bay. Interestingly, word came through today that Hurricane Charley, which had been predicted to hit southern Florida as a Category 4 hurricane, actually just hit the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico as a tropical storm. Had that hurricane stayed on its original track, this relief effort would have been completely lost at sea. Reporting from the front in Miami, Florida, I'm Kate Malik. Back to you, Brian.
Next, we go to a disturbing story of a missing cargo ship. The dry bulk cargo carrier Autumn Dawn was outbound from New Orleans with a shipment of agricultural supplies bound for China. when it contacted U.S. Pacific Command and reported that it was losing control of the ship due to infection. Experts are concerned that one of the crew members may have been a latent controller who brought the infection on board and passed the disease to their shipmates. The vessel is now missing, with the presumption that the crew is reanimated. Our Chuck Fleming is at U.S. Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C. with more.
I'm here at the Douglas A. Monroe Coast Guard headquarters building in Washington, D.C., waiting for a statement from Coast Guard Admiral Robert Fletcher. And I can tell you that the atmosphere is one of nervousness as U.S. and Chinese officials try to determine what happened to a 1,500-foot cargo vessel bound for China. The vessel, which left New Orleans 25 days ago. Actually, Brian, we're going to take you directly to Admiral Fletcher, who's about to give a statement.
My name is Admiral Robert Fletcher. I am in command of the United States Coast Guard's 14th District, which is the district that was last in response with the bulk carrier cargo ship Autumn Dawn. At approximately 0900 hours on Thursday, we received a distress call from the Autumn Dawn that she had experienced an outbreak on board, that all crew members were symptomatic, and that some crew members had reanimated. At that time, the Autumn Dawn was approximately 1,400 miles southwest of Hawaii and about 10 days from its final destination at the port of Shanghai in China.
all stations, Mayday, mayday, mayday. This is the cargo vessel Autumn Dawn, en route to China, Shanghai, China. Current position, 1 degree, 30 minutes south latitude, 167 degrees, 0 minutes west longitude. Anybody on this one? Over.
Autumn Dawn, this is the United States Coast Guard Group Honolulu. What is the nature of your emergency?
We're en route to Shanghai, China. We're 22 days out from New Orleans. It got us quick. We lost the ship.
Calm down, Autumn Dawn. Calm down. I repeat, what is the nature of your emergency? Over.
It started with the XO. The XO had it first. Now everybody's got it. Half the crew is already reanimated. Over.
Okay. I need you to listen closely, sailor. I need you to get to the bridge.
I think there's still some guys. There's still some guys alive in the engine room.
Listen to me, sailor. I need you to get to the bridge and set a course for 21 degrees, 43 minutes north latitude, 158 degrees west longitude. Can you do that for me, sailor?
We ordered the ship to change course to Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, but we believe the crew had already lost control and we were unable to reestablish contact. Unfortunately, the Autumn Dawn was already outside the newly established search perimeter of both the United States Coast Guard and the United States Navy when the distress call came in, and no recovery operations could be initiated. We are grateful to our partners in the Australian and Philippine navies who have offered to search for the vessel to the extent their resources permit. And we are certain that this effort, in conjunction with commercial vessels maintaining a diligent watch, will allow us to relocate and reclaim the ship.
What the Admiral failed to mention is that this wasn't just a ship, or even just a merchant ship. This was the Autumn Dawn, a first-in-its-class 1,500-foot Capesize container ship christened shortly before the pandemic outbreak last year. She left port loaded with 600,000 tons of rice, corn, and soybeans, commodities the Chinese government desperately needs. Experts point out that China, which has suffered as much as any nation in the pandemic, had long pursued an agricultural policy but was heavily reliant on imports. To provide our listeners with a better understanding of the importance of this ship, we spent some time today with Dr. Fang Huang, senior fellow at the China Policy Research Institute here in Washington, where she told us this.
From the perspective of agricultural development, China has been conducting a precarious balancing act for some time, since the beginning of the new millennium, really. And now the country is suffering from a perfect storm of negative outcomes initiated by bad policy and seriously exacerbated by the pandemic. Before the crisis, China had already repurposed much of its farmland for real estate development. And of the farmland that was not developed, over 20% of it was industrially contaminated so badly it could no longer be farmed. The government's solution was to rely heavily on imports and buy land for agricultural development in other countries, principally in other parts of Asia, Africa, and South America, and then ship the harvested product back to China. But now, the pandemic has made it impossible to farm those regions, and many of China's traditional trading partners are incapable of exporting products themselves.
So, Dr. Huang, what would the loss of this ship mean to China?
Well, it is only one ship, but at this point, every supply ship is critical. Before the pandemic, the United States was already the country's largest exporter of food, representing 20% of all agricultural imports to China. The Chinese government stopped releasing updated figures after the pandemic outbreak, but certainly, the percentage of total imports from the United States is much higher, while overall imports are certainly down. This means China is at an enormous deficit when it comes to their food requirements. I'm sure they were counting on this ship.
If the ship were to maintain its last known course and speed, it should reappear off the coast of Taiwan in about 6 days. However, a Category 2 typhoon has developed in the Western Pacific directly in the ship's path. This would almost certainly blow the ship off course, and with no living crew members to generate a course correction, it's anyone's guess where the autumn dawn will be seen next. At the Douglas A. Monroe Building in Washington, D.C., I'm Chuck Fleming.
Next, we go to the Central Valley of California, where a quiet forward operating base of the United States Army has become the unlikely host of a high-spirited competition between two sniper teams deployed there. The base was considered to be a sleepy assignment, providing security to agricultural workers in an area surrounded by dead cities. But with egos and reputations now on the line, it's the site of a thrilling competition for top sniper. RLA's Laura Sanders reports from California.
I'm here in Freedom Plains, California, a small farming town that makes a big impact nationally for its production of everything from almonds to oranges to cotton. Not much happens here in Freedom Plains, but like many agricultural communities in California's Central Valley, its proximity to the dead cities of San Francisco, Sacramento, and Los Angeles means it is under constant threat of reanimate incursion, requiring an outsized military presence. Quiet though this assignment may seem, two sniper teams of the Army's 1st Battalion, 73rd Cavalry Regiment, found a fun way to beat the boredom while garnering national attention. I caught up with them today and was lucky enough to see the competition in action.
Shooter, by I go to 3 Bravo.
Contact.
From 3 Bravo, go to the 3 o'clock, approximately 30 mils.
Contact.
Go to glass.
All right, so I got Romeo Alpha coming through the tree line. Looks to be alone.
That is your target. Check parallax and mil.
You're gonna take that shot now? That's 2,000 meters, bro.
It's because the news lady's here. They're showing off.
Stay focused, Marks. Check parallax and mil.
1.12.
Check level. Hold over 4.25.
Ready.
Right 0.2.
Swing and a miss, Danny boy.
Come left approximately 10 mils. Come up 2 clicks.
Ready.
Left 0.1.
strike two, Danny. You nervous, bro?
I'd let her get a little closer if I were you, hermano. She's heading this way. You're gonna lose this thing right in front of the RLA people.
Come left 5 mils, come up 1 click.
Ready.
Center.
All right! I think that got her right in the eye. You see that head come apart?
God damn it. Nice shooting, Danny. Nice shooting.
Thank you, thank you. And just for the record, that was 2,012 meters. That's a tournament record, if I'm not mistaken.
The two sniper teams composed of Sergeants Daniel Marks, Kathy Nowak, Miguel Hernandez, and KV Baga have been friends since they received advanced training at Fort Bragg in North Carolina and came up with the competition as a way to help pass the time in this sleepy corner of the pandemic front line. The rules are simple. The target has to be at least 500 meters away, and the shooter gets 3 tries on the target. Tell us, how did you come up with these rules?
We wanted the competition to go on for a while, so we didn't want to go too crazy with distance. I mean, a great sniper can hit a target from over 3,000 meters, but we knew early on we wanted it to be close enough that we could put up some big numbers.
Yeah, and we felt like one shot wasn't enough. Early in the competition, I was taking a shot in the target trip just as I was squeezing off the round, and I said, come on, that's not fair.
Yeah, I was like, that's not fair. Mine stood there like a statue, and KV's trips? I said, you get another shot, bro.
Then the nasty son of a bitch tripped again as I'm sending my second shot downrange. He was standing in high grass, so we couldn't see it at the time, but it turned out one of his feet had been chewed off, so he kept tripping.
And I was like, okay, Baga, I'll give you one more shot.
The only other rule we have is that it has to be a single target. The reanimate positioning beacons in the cities do a pretty good job of keeping them centralized, but sometimes a bigger herd will break off and head this way. One day, we had 800 reanimates pop out of that very tree line. When that kind of thing happens, we gotta focus on the job.
Yeah, we can't be dicking around with the competition when we get a group of them like that.
Okay, so who's in the lead?
With that shot today, Nowak and I are in the lead with 722.
We're at 721.
Yeah, we're at 721.
Brian, I conducted that interview earlier today, and while my crew and I were packing up, the team of Sergeants Hernandez and Baga scored their 722nd and 23rd kills, taking the lead by one. Although, based on the sounds behind me, it's possible that Team Nowak and Marks have already retaken the lead. The two teams have yet to determine what the winner's prize will be, but the competition is being watched with great enthusiasm by Army Command. And I am sure whoever wins this noble event will be rewarded handsomely for their achievement. From Freedom Plains, California, I'm Laura Sanders.
True heroism personified. When we return, I'll be joined at the RLA discussion table by Dr. Hiroshi Watanabe.
Hey, Steve, how's it going?
Hey, Poochie, you're a good dog. Where you been?
Oh, God, Tom, you didn't hear? It was awful.
No, what happened?
Well, you know the liquor store shelves have been a little bare, so I tried to distill my own whiskey.
Okay.
And, well, I didn't do it too well, and I went blind for 3 weeks.
Oh, Christ.
Yeah, I'll never do that again.
Well, hold on there, son. I don't know if I like the sounds of that.
Who are you?
Who am I? I'm your Uncle Sally Joe.
Uncle? Are you from my mother's side?
No, I'm from your thirsty side. Don't let one little bout of blindness stop you from enjoying your favorite corn liquors. Not when corn is one of the only things not on the ration list. Order Uncle Sally Joe's home distillery kit.
Uncle Sally Joe's what?
Uncle Sally Joe's home distillery kit, fool. Each kit comes with a fermenter, distillation column, and condenser, and importantly, a built-in temperature control system. And with Uncle Sally Joe's instant read methylate test strips, you can drink away without the anxiety of waking up without your eyesight.
Hey, thanks, Uncle Sally Joe. I'm going to order my kit today.
You and me both.
Welcome back. We take you now to the RLA discussion table where I'm fortunate to be joined by Dr. Hiroshi Watanabe, Chair of the Department of Artificial Intelligence and Robotics at Tokyo's Meiji University, now established in a lab at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Dr. Watanabe, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. I am honored to be here.
Dr. Watanabe, I want to spend most of our time on your work at MIT, but I was hoping you could give our listeners a sense what those last moments in Tokyo were like.
It's a painful memory, even now.
I apologize. We could...
It's fine. I was at my lab at the university. The city had been hit with multiple wildfire outbreaks, the first and the biggest of which was in the 23rd Ward, which is very close to the university.
The 23rd Ward? That was the government district.
That's right. We had all been told to stay off the streets and wait for instructions from the government. Like all good citizens of Tokyo, I complied and stayed with my research assistants in my lab. There were rumors going around that the American military base in Okinawa had mobilized, and we assumed they were coming to Tokyo.
But they were actually mobilizing to return to the United States.
That's right. You have to remember, we had a police force in Tokyo, and we had a small national defense force in Japan, but we hadn't had a standing army since World War II. We had always relied on America for our defense, so when reanimates start to reach critical mass, there was almost nothing stopping them.
So then what happened?
A young lieutenant from the Tokushu Sakusengu, the counter-terrorism arm of Japan Self-Defense Force, came into my lab with two other soldiers. He told me I had to evacuate with him immediately. I told him I wouldn't leave without my research assistants, and I demand to know where we are going. And then he handed me a sealed document.
And what were the contents of that document?
I still keep it to myself, but it carried the seal of the Crown Prince Emperor Naruhito himself. I shared it with my staff and bid them a tearful goodbye. I was then driven to Narita Airport, a terrifying 45-mile trip, loaded onto a transport plane with Japan's greatest national treasures and flown to Hawaii. The last moments were terrifying. The plane was still being fueled and serviced when I got on board. And there were reanimates coming across the airport at us. I can still see the look of the refueling technician who stood on his station while the reanimate came at him.
Truly terrifying. Dr. Watanabe, when we were joined by Joint Chiefs Chairman Ibibio on this show, he saw robotics, and your work specifically, is the future of our struggle against those that have already become victim to the pandemic. What can you tell us about your developments?
Robotics are a good solution for this. But there's problems too.
What do you mean by problems?
Well, you want the robots to destroy the reanimate. That's easy to accomplish. But you have to remember, this is a true artificial intelligence. It evolves. If you give it a purpose, that purpose can evolve too.
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Let me give you an example. We did an experiment with a set of three artificially intelligent programs. This was strictly in the virtual realm. We gave them an assignment to harvest fruit from a virtual tree and consume it, which they did, very efficiently. But when the fruit from the tree ran out, two of them consumed the third AI program. We still aren't sure why they did this. Either they were incapable of distinguishing between the fruit of the tree and another artificially intelligent program, or two of them made a conscious decision to perform an act of virtual cannibalism. In either case, it would be unsafe to weaponize such a technology.
That is disturbing.
It continues. We did a live fire experiment with functioning AI-driven robots. It put them in a containment area with some captured reanimates. There were 4 robots and about 30 reanimates. And the protocol was for them to destroy all reanimates, which they did very quickly. But after they had destroyed all reanimates, they gathered amongst themselves and through a satellite uplink, began to communicate amongst themselves in a language we could not understand.
That is scary.
Not as scary as what happened next.
And what was that?
3 of the robots gathered together and destroyed the 4th robot.
My God.
Then 2 coordinate against 1, and then the 2 that remain engage in single combat, and ultimately, only 1 robot survive. And that survivor was experiencing high levels of stress for lack of target. To those artificially intelligent subjects, killing, destroying, became the same to them as eating is to us. In another similar experiment, again with 4 AI-equipped robots, we tried to make it a contest. We didn't just give robots the mission to destroy the reanimates. We programmed them to want to destroy more than their peers. As soon as the exercise began, one of the robots immediately destroyed the other 3 and then went on to only kill 1 reanimate and technically declare itself winner of the exercise.
So where does that leave us? Are we still far away from being able to deploy robotics on the battlefield?
Muzukashii ne. It's hard. We could deploy a robotic response now. What we can't do is guarantee what that robot is going to do. They evolve. They are thinking creations. I could deliver a functioning robot with a holographic baiting ability and a pneumatically powered weapon capable of neutralizing a reanimate in a very short amount of time. But it would be very expensive. And I could not promise what its behavior would be after we got it in the field. Given the cost of such a weapon system, we have to be absolutely certain that it will maintain the appropriate command protocol.
It sounds hard to be optimistic on the program based on our discussion, does it not?
No, I would not say that at all. This is a new technology, and we have amazing, wonderful ideas for it. Imagine an artificially intelligent army that can be deployed into the field and then recharge from a special AI dirigible drone equipped with solar sails. You could retake a city like Los Angeles or Tokyo without ever risking a single animate life. That is the goal. That is what we are researching towards.
Dr. Watanabe, thank you so much for being here. We know how important your time is, and we thank you for the hard work you're doing. That concludes today's program. For Radio Living America, I'm Brian Andrews, asking that you stay safe, stay alert, and stay in the fight.